where the government of Mohammad Mossadegh was challenging the monopoly held by Britain's Anglo-Iranian oil company, the forerunner of British Petroleum, BP, and the world's third largest crude oil producer. The company, which was 51% owned by the British government, had developed cozy relations with Reza Shah Pahlavi, who had seized power after World War I and become Shah in 1925, and with his son Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, who replaced his father in 1941, when the elder's Nazi sympathies had provoked a joint occupation of Iran by Britain and the Soviet Union. Anglo-Iranian kept 84% of the revenue for itself, leaving at most a paltry 16% for the Iranians. It paid taxes in Britain rather than Iran. In fact, its British taxes were more than double the amount that the Iranians received in royalties. While the British got rich off Iranian oil, the Iranians lived in poverty. Oil field workers earned less than 50 cents per day and received no benefits or vacations. The Iranians' outrage was ignited in 1950 when the U.S. oil company Aramco signed a contract giving Saudi Arabia 50% of the profits from Saudi oil. Under pressure, Anglo-Iranian offered improved terms, but Mossadegh so hated British colonialism that he refused to consider the company's offer. The Iranian parliament, reflecting Iranians' near-universal antipathy toward Anglo-Iranian, voted unanimously to nationalize the oil industry and compensate the British for their investment. Britain's Labour government seemed hardly in a position to object, having nationalized Britain's coal and electricity companies and railroads. A former finance and foreign minister, Mossadegh, despite his legendary eccentricities, was an enormously popular figure inside Iran, and a well-respected one internationally. He was the first Iranian to earn a Doctor of Law degree from a European university. He had attended the Versailles Conference in a futile attempt to block the assertion of British control, and had led the decolonization fight in succeeding decades. Time magazine named him Man of the Year for 1951. The U.S. ambassador reported that Mossadegh has the backing of 95% to 98% of the people of this country. His defiance of the colonial masters thrilled the Arab masses throughout the region. With Iran producing 40% of Middle Eastern oil, the United States understood the importance of easing the tension. It had been pushing the British to improve their offer and avoid the crisis since 1948. Truman derided Sir William Fraser, the head of Anglo-Iranian, as a typical 19th-century colonial exploiter. Members of the British cabinet responded in the fashion typical of 20th-century colonial exploiters and debated the pros and cons of invading. It became clear that such an invasion would prove costly and might not succeed. But capitulating to the Iranians, some felt, could put the final nail in the empire's coffin. If Persia were allowed to get away with it, Egypt and other Middle Eastern countries would be encouraged to think they could try things on, Defense Minister Emmanuel Shinwell feared. The next thing might be an attempt to nationalize the Suez Canal. Opposition leader Winston Churchill told Prime Minister Clement Attlee that he was rather shocked at the attitude of the United States, who did not seem to appreciate fully the importance of the great area extending from the Caspian to the Persian Gulf. It was more important than Korea. Foreign Secretary Herbert Morrison also deplored the policy of scuttle and surrender. Acheson attempted to mediate, fearing that military action by Great Britain in the south might provoke a Soviet incursion in the north. Though frustrated by Mossadegh's intransigence, Acheson sympathized with the Iranians' position. He convinced Averell Harriman to go to Tehran to defuse the situation. Harriman reported that the situation that has developed here is a tragic example of absentee management combined with worldwide growth of nationalism in underdeveloped countries. The British put the invasion on hold, initiating economic warfare in its stead. They embargoed oil coming out of Iran and goods going in. With U.S. approval, the Bank of England halted the finance of and trade with Iran. The Iranian economy slowly ground to a halt. Winston Churchill and his Conservative Party returned to power in October 1951, increasing the pressure for military intervention. Churchill had earlier written to Truman that Mussy Duck was an elderly lunatic bent on wrecking his country and handing it over to communism. When Mossadegh got wind of British plans to launch a coup, he shut the British embassy and expelled its employees. When Eisenhower took office, the Dulles brothers met with Kermit Kim Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, and the CIA's top Middle East expert, to discuss eliminating that madman Mossadegh. John Foster Dulles acknowledged that Mossadegh wasn't a communist, but he feared a takeover by the communist Tudeh Party that would deliver Iran's oil to Moscow. Soon, he argued, the rest of Middle Eastern oil would come under Soviet control. Mossadegh had moved closer to Tudeh as the crisis unfolded. The new administration portrayed Mossadegh as an unstable extremist, not quite sane, according to U.S. Ambassador Loy Henderson. Behind the scenes, the CIA went to work, launching Operation Ajax, headed by Roosevelt. British intelligence, MI6, provided support. But things did not go as planned. When the CIA's Tehran station chief opposed this tawdry operation as being inimical to the United States' long-term interests, Alan Dulles fired him. Mossadegh uncovered the Shah's collaboration with the coup attempt, forcing the Shah to flee the country. The CIA, meanwhile, had been buying up Iranian journalists, preachers, army and police officers, and members of parliament, who were instructed to foment opposition to the government. The CIA also purchased the services of the extremist Warriors of Islam, a terrorist gang, according to a CIA history of the coup. In August, Roosevelt began setting mobs loose to create chaos in the capital, Tehran. He spread rumors that Mossadegh was a communist and a Jew. His street thugs, pretending to be members of the Tudeh Party, attacked mullahs and destroyed a mosque. Among the rioters was Ayatollah Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, Iran's future leader. On August 19, 1953, in the midst of the anarchy, Roosevelt brought General Fazlollah Zahidi out of his CIA hiding place. Zahidi announced that the Shah, then in Italy, had appointed him the new prime minister. After an armed battle, coup plotters arrested Mossadegh and thousands of his supporters. Some were executed. Mossadegh was convicted of treason and imprisoned. The Shah returned to Tehran. At a final meeting with Roosevelt, the Shah offered a toast. "I owe my throne to God, my people, my army, and to you." The American oil companies were also grateful. Previously frozen out of Iranian oil production, five U.S. oil companies now received 40% ownership of the new consortium established to develop Iranian oil, and the United States opened its coffers to the Shah. Within 2 weeks of the coup, the United States granted Iran $68 million in emergency aid, with more than $100 million more soon to follow. The United States had gained an ally and access to an enormous supply of oil, but in the process had outraged the citizens of a proud nation whose resentment at the overthrow of their popular prime minister and imposition of a repressive regime would later come back to haunt it. The Shah continued to rule for more than 25 years with strong U.S. backing by fixing elections and relying on the repressive power of SAVAK, his newly created intelligence service. The CIA, having toppled its first government, now saw itself as capable of replicating the feat elsewhere, and would attempt to do so repeatedly in succeeding years. The Soviets, therefore, instead of seeing a softening of U.S. policy in the aftermath of Stalin's death, saw the United States impose another puppet government in a nation with which the Soviet Union shared a 1,000-kilometer border, as part of an ongoing strategy of encirclement. On the heels of this success in Iran, the Eisenhower administration targeted the small, impoverished Central American nation of Guatemala. Guatemalans had suffered under a brutal U.S.-backed dictator, Jorge Ubico, whom they overthrew in 1944. Before the reform government took power, 2% of the population owned 60% of the land, while 50% of the people eked out a living on only 3% of the land. The Indian half of Guatemala's population barely survived on less than 50 cents per day. In 1950, Guatemalans elected the handsome, charismatic, 38-year-old Colonel Jacobo Arbenz Guzman president in an election remarkable for its fairness. At his March 1951 inauguration, he declared his commitment to social justice and reform. "All the riches of Guatemala are not as important as the life, the freedom, the dignity, the health, and the happiness of the most humble of its people. We must distribute these riches so that those who have less, and they are the immense majority, benefit more, while those who have more, and they are so few, also benefit, but to a lesser extent. How could it be otherwise, given the poverty, the poor health, and the lack of education of our people?" The U.S. media wasted little time in denouncing Guatemala's communist tyranny, beginning its assault long before Arbenz had time to start implementing his reform agenda. In June, the New York Times decried the Guatemalan cancer, registering a sense of deep disappointment and disillusionment over the trend of Guatemalan politics in the 2 months since Colonel Arbenz became president. The editors took particular umbrage at the growth of communist influence, complaining that the government's policy is either running parallel to or is a front for Russian imperialism in Central America. The Washington Post carried an editorial a few months later titled "Red Cell in Guatemala" that branded the new president of Guatemala's Congress a straight party-liner and dismissed Arbenz as little more than a tool. Ignoring his critics, Arbenz set out to modernize Guatemala's industry and agriculture and develop its mineral resources. To do so meant challenging the power of United Fruit Company, which dominated the Guatemalan economy. Called the Octopus by Guatemalans, United Fruit reached its tentacle-like arms deep into railroads, ports, shipping, and especially banana plantations. Arbenz announced plans for a massive land reform program, beginning with the nationalization of 234,000 acres of United Fruit Company land, more than 90% of which the company was not using. In all, the company's 550,000 acres represented approximately one-fifth of Guatemala's arable land. Arbenz offered to compensate United Fruit in the amount of $600,000, based on the company's own greatly underpriced assessment of the land's value in previous tax returns. The company demanded more. Arbenz took steps to appropriate another 173,000 acres. The public relations pioneer and master propagandist Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew, had already launched a campaign to brand Arbenz a communist. He found willing allies at the New York Times. Bernays paid a visit to Times publisher Arthur Hayes Sulzberger. Dutifully, the Times soon began publishing articles about the communist threat in Guatemala. Leading congressmen, including Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, whose family had gorged on United Fruit for decades, decried this growing communist menace. Truman took heed of the alleged communist threat emanating from Guatemala. In April 1952, he hosted a state dinner for Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza, who had long been persona non grata in Washington. Somoza assured State Department officials that if the United States would provide arms, he and exiled Guatemalan Colonel Carlos Castillo Armas would get rid of Arbenz. The Truman administration decided to overthrow Arbenz in September 1952, but reversed course when U.S. involvement was exposed. Eisenhower had no such compunctions. He appointed Jack Purifoy as his ambassador to Guatemala. Purifoy, who spoke no Spanish, had been serving in Greece, where his role in helping restore the monarchy to power had earned him the sobriquet, the Butcher of Athens. A photo of the Greek royal family still adorned his desk. His penchant for wearing a gun in his belt led his wife to nickname him Pistol-Packing Purifoy. Before Greece, he had helped purge the State Department of liberals and leftists. Arbenz invited the new U.S. ambassador and his wife to dinner. They clashed for 6 hours over communist influence in the Guatemalan government, land reform, and treatment of United Fruit. Purifoy sent Secretary of State Dulles a long cable detailing their discussion that concluded, "I am definitely convinced that if the president is not a communist, he will certainly do until one comes along." In Purifoy's mind, that equated to being a tool of Moscow. Communism is directed by the Kremlin all over the world, and anyone who thinks differently doesn't know what he is talking about. In reality, Guatemalan communism was indigenous, and the Partido Guatemalteco del Trabajo was independent of the Soviet Union. The communists held only 4 of the 56 seats in Congress and no cabinet posts. The party had approximately 4,000 members in a population of 3.5 million. To suggest that United Fruit had friends among the high and mighty in the Eisenhower administration would be an understatement. The Dulles brothers' law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, had written United Fruit's 1930 and 1936 agreements with Guatemala. Alan Dulles's predecessor at the CIA, Undersecretary of State Walter Bedell Smith, would become a vice president of the company in 1955. Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs John Moores Cabot was a major shareholder. His brother, Thomas Dudley Cabot, the Director of International Security Affairs in the State Department, had been president of United Fruit. NSC head General Robert Cutler had been chairman of the board. John J. McCloy was a former board member. And U.S. Ambassador to Costa Rica Robert Hill would later join the board. Concerns about United Fruit interests reinforced the Eisenhower administration's deep-seated anti-communism. In August 1953, administration officials decided to take Arbenz down through covert action. One U.S. official cautioned, "Were it to become known that the United States had tried a Czechoslovakia in Guatemala, the effect on our relations in this hemisphere, and probably in the world, could be disastrous." Undeterred, Alan Dulles asked Iran coup instigator Kim Roosevelt to lead Operation Success, but Roosevelt declined, not trusting that the operation's title reflected the prospects on the ground. Dulles then chose Colonel Albert Haney, a former South Korean station chief, as field commander, with Tracy Barnes as chief of political warfare. As Tim Weiner points out in his history of the CIA, Barnes had the classic CIA resume of that era. Raised on Long Island's Whitney Estate, replete with its own private golf course, he matriculated at Groton, Yale, and Harvard Law. Serving with the OSS in World War II, he captured a German garrison, earning him a Silver Star. But because Barnes had a reputation as a bumbler, former CIA director Walter Bedell Smith, a Dulles protege, was tasked with overseeing the operation. In late January 1954, word leaked out that the United States was collaborating with Colonel Castillo Armas to train the invading force. The Guatemalan government then turned to Czechoslovakia for a shipload of arms. The United States loudly decried Soviet penetration of the hemisphere. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Alexander Wiley, described the allegedly massive shipment as part of the master plan of world communism. The Speaker of the House deemed it an atom bomb in America's backyard. In a surprising reversal, New York Times correspondent Sidney Grusin began providing coverage of the unfolding Guatemalan crisis that accurately captured the nation's outrage over U.S. bullying and accusations. Grusin had just been allowed back into the country after having been expelled by the government as undesirable in February. On May 21st, he wrote that U.S. pressure had boomeranged inspiring a greater degree of national unity than Guatemala has experienced in a long time. Even Guatemala newspapers, that normally are in constant opposition, he reported, have rallied to defend the government's action. Both newspapers, he noted, had assailed what they termed the United States' willingness to provide arms to right-wing dictators in the hemisphere, while refusing to fulfill Guatemala's legitimate needs. In another front-page article the following day, Grusin recounted the Guatemalan foreign minister's charge that the U.S. State Department was aiding exiles abroad and domestic dissidents who were trying to overthrow the government. He reported that the State Department had pressured Guatemala to raise its compensation to United Fruit to $16 million, and quoted the foreign minister's assertion that Guatemala is not a colony of the United States, nor an associated state that requires permission of the United States government to acquire the things indispensable for its defense and security. And it repudiates the pretension of the United States to supervise the legitimate acts of a sovereign government. On the 24th, Grusin insisted that the United States had chosen the wrong issue to make a stand on, and had only sparked a great upsurge of nationalism and anti-Americanism. Grusin's days as a Times reporter in Guatemala were numbered. Over dinner, Alan Dulles spoke to his friend, Times business manager Julius Adler, who conveyed the administration's complaints to publisher Sulzberger. Grusin was sent packing to Mexico City. Meanwhile, Purifoy and other U.S. officials waged a vigorous propaganda and disinformation campaign, both inside Guatemala and in neighboring states, to discredit the Arbenz government and weaken its hold on power. In June 1954, CIA-trained mercenaries attacked from bases in Honduras and Nicaragua, backed by U.S. air support. When the initial attack stalled, Eisenhower provided Castillo Armas with additional planes. Even British and French officials balked at the thought of supporting such naked aggression. Henry Cabot Lodge, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, confronted his British and French counterparts and threatened to withdraw U.S. support to Great Britain on Egypt and Cyprus, and to France on Tunisia and Morocco, if they failed to back the United States on Guatemala. On June 27th, Arbenz, assuming that resistance was futile, handed power to a military junta headed by the Army Chief of Staff. That night he delivered a final radio address in which he charged, "The United Fruit Company, in collaboration with the governing circles of the United States, is responsible for what is happening to us." He warned about 20 years of fascist bloody tyranny. That night, the CIA station chief and another agent visited the new head of the junta and told him, "You're just not convenient for the requirements of American foreign policy." When he refused to step down, the CIA bombed the parade ground of the main military base and the government radio station. Castillo Armas, who had been trained at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, returned in a U.S. embassy plane to head the new government. Dulles addressed the American public on June 30th and applauded the victory of democracy over Soviet communism. He announced that the situation was being cured by the Guatemalans themselves. One British official, gagging on Dulles's mendacity, observed of the speech that, "In places, it might almost be Molotov speaking about Czechoslovakia, or Hitler about Austria." Shortly thereafter, Castillo Armas visited Washington and assured Nixon of his fealty. "Tell me what you want me to do, and I will do it," he promised the vice president. He received $90 million in U.S. aid in the next 2 years, 150 times as much as the reform government had received in a decade. He set up a brutal military dictatorship and was assassinated 3 years later. United Fruit got its land back. Dulles said that the country had been saved from communist imperialism and declared the addition of a new and glorious chapter to the already great tradition of the American states. One retired Marine Corps colonel who participated in the overthrow wrote later that, "Our success led to 31 years of repressive military rule and the deaths of more than 100,000 Guatemalans. The actual death toll might have been twice that number. Arbenz proved to have been optimistic when he predicted 20 years of fascist bloody tyranny. The fascist bloody tyranny in Guatemala actually lasted 40 years. While Eisenhower administration officials celebrated their victory, having fortified their belief that covert operations could be used to topple popular reform governments, others drew very different lessons. Among the witnesses to Guatemalan regime change was a young Argentinian doctor named Ernesto Che Guevara, who was in Guatemala City to observe Arbenz's reform efforts. He wrote to his mother from the Argentinian embassy, where he had taken refuge during the subsequent slaughter. Arbenz made one major mistake, he contended. He could have given arms to the people, but he did not want to. And now we see the result. Che would not make that mistake when the time came to protect the Cuban Revolution a few years later. The revolution faced its main counter-revolutionary challenge when an invading force of U.S.-backed exiles was smashed in 1961 at the Bay of Pigs. Several of those who played leading roles in the Guatemalan overthrow of 1954 would also figure prominently in the 1961 fiasco, including Ambassador William Pauley, CIA operatives E. Howard Hunt and Richard Bissell, Tracy Barnes, and Alan Dulles. Events of even greater significance were unfolding simultaneously in Vietnam. In April 1954, Ho Chi Minh's Peasant Liberation Army, commanded by General Vo Nguyen Giap, and peasant supporters hauled extremely heavy anti-aircraft guns, mortars, and howitzers through seemingly impassable jungle and mountain terrain to lay siege to desperate French forces at Dien Bien Phu. Incredibly, the United States was then paying 80% of the French costs to keep the colonialists in power. Eisenhower explained in August 1953, "When the United States votes $400 million to help that war, we are not voting a giveaway program. We are voting for the cheapest way that we can to prevent the occurrence of something that would be of a most terrible significance to the United States of America, our security, our power, and ability to get certain things we need from the riches of the Indonesia territory and from Southeast Asia." He envisioned countries in the region falling like dominoes, ultimately leading to the loss of Japan. Nixon agreed. If Indochina falls, Thailand is put in an almost impossible position. The same is true of Malaya with its rubber and tin. The same is true of Indonesia. If this whole part of Southeast Asia goes under communist domination or communist influence, Japan, who trades and must trade with this area in order to exist, must inevitably be oriented toward the communist regime. And U.S. News and World Report cut entirely through any rhetoric about fighting for the freedom of oppressed peoples and admitted, "One of the world's richest areas is open to the winner in Indochina. That's behind growing U.S. concern. Tin, rubber, rice, key strategic raw materials are what the war is really about. The U.S. sees it as a place to hold, at any cost." The French asked for help. Though Eisenhower ruled out sending U.S. ground forces, he and Dulles considered various options to stave off an imminent French defeat. Pentagon officials drew up plans for Operation Vulture, an air campaign against Viet Minh positions. They also discussed the possibility of using two or three atomic bombs. Air Force Chief of Staff General Nathan Twining later commented, "What Radford and I thought would be, and I still think it would have been, a good idea, was to take three small tactical A-bombs. It's a fairly isolated area. You could take all day to drop a bomb, make sure you put it in the right place. No opposition. And clean those commies out of there, and the band could play the Marseillaise, and the French would come marching out of Dien Bien Phu in fine shape." And those commies would say, "Well, those guys may do this to us again. We'd better be careful." Eisenhower discussed the use of atomic bombs with Nixon and Robert Cutler of the NSC on April 30th, 1954. Foreign Minister Georges Bidault and other French officials reported that Dulles had offered them two atomic bombs 1 week earlier. Eisenhower and Dulles later disputed such reports, but the use of atomic bombs would certainly have been consistent with U.S. policy at the time. Neither the British nor the French thought this wise or feasible. Evidence also suggests that the new weapons were vetoed because the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu were too close to French soldiers, who would be put into harm's way. As Eisenhower told Walter Cronkite in 1961, "We were not willing to use weapons that could have destroyed the area for miles and that probably would have destroyed Dien Bien Phu." Many scholars believe Eisenhower's and Dulles' disclaimers, but the United States offer is mentioned in diaries and memoirs of French General Paul Ely, Foreign Minister Bidault, and Foreign Ministry Secretary General Jean Chauvel. France's Interior Minister had asked Premier Laniel to request the bombs. McGeorge Bundy also thinks it likely that Dulles raised the possibility with Bidault, as Bidault claimed, in part because the alleged offer coincided precisely with Dulles's comments to NATO about the necessity of making nuclear weapons conventional. In late April, the policy planning staff of the NSC again discussed the prospect of using nuclear weapons. When Robert Cutler broached the subject with Eisenhower and Nixon, the record indicates that they again considered giving a few of the new weapons to the French. Years later, Eisenhower's recollection was quite different. He told his biographer Stephen Ambrose that he had replied to Cutler, "You boys must be crazy. We can't use those awful things against Asians for the second time in less than 10 years. My God." Although no nuclear weapons were used at the time, Eisenhower did approve the Joint Chiefs' recommendation that should the Chinese intervene, the United States would respond with atomic bombs, not ground troops. The day before Eisenhower's falling domino press conference, Massachusetts Senator John F. Kennedy had taken the floor of the Senate to oppose the proposed U.S. military intervention. He dismissed the optimistic blather with which U.S. and French officials had been regaling the public for the past 3 years, including recent assurances of French victory by Arthur Radford and Secretary Dulles. "No amount of American military assistance in Indochina can conquer an enemy which is everywhere and at the same time nowhere, an enemy of the people, which has the sympathy and covert support of the people." Senator Lyndon Johnson had recently said that he was against sending American GIs into the mud and muck of Indochina on a bloodletting spree to perpetuate colonialism and white man's exploitation in Asia. On May 7th, after 56 days, the French garrison fell. Representatives of the United States, France, Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and China met in Geneva. Dulles attended just long enough to make his displeasure apparent. He refused to shake hands with Chinese Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai, or to sit near any communist delegates, and he objected to everything that was proposed, causing British Foreign Minister Anthony Eden's secretary to describe his almost pathological rage and gloom. Despite the fact that the Viet Minh controlled most of the country, and believed it deserved to govern it all, Viet Minh negotiators succumbed to Soviet and Chinese pressure, and accepted a proposal that would briefly defer their nationwide takeover and allow France to save face. The two sides agreed to temporarily divide Vietnam at the 17th parallel, with Ho's forces withdrawing to the north and French-backed forces retreating to the south. The final declaration clearly stated, "The military demarcation line is provisional and should not in any way be interpreted as constituting a political or territorial boundary." The agreement also stipulated that neither side allow foreign bases on its soil or join a military alliance. The Viet Minh accepted this, in large part, because a national election was scheduled for July 1956 to unify the country. The United States refused to sign the accords, but promised not to interfere with their implementation. But in fact, it was betraying that promise as the words were coming out of U.S. Representative General Walter Bethel Smith's mouth. "So long as Bao Dai remained in charge of the South, the United States' prospects of holding Vietnam were virtually non-existent." Bao Dai was unknown by the peasants and scorned as a French puppet and despised by the intellectuals, while Ho was heralded as a nationalist leader and adulated as the country's savior. As French troops prepared to leave the country, Americans maneuvered to replace Bao Dai with Ngo Dinh Diem, a conservative Catholic fresh from 4 years in exile, whom Bao had named prime minister. With the aid of Edward Lansdale, Diem wasted no time in crushing rivals and unleashing a wave of repression against former Viet Minh members in the South, thousands of whom were executed. In 1955, Diem called a referendum, asking the South Vietnamese to choose between Bao Dai and himself. With the assistance of Lansdale, Diem won 98% of the vote. Diem's U.S. backers formed the American Friends of Vietnam. Diem enthusiasts included Cardinal Francis Spellman and Joseph Kennedy, as well as Senators Mike Mansfield, Hubert Humphrey, and John F. Kennedy. Blinded by their anti-communism and their faith that this ascetic Catholic nationalist could turn the tide against overwhelming odds, they ignored what was obvious to independent observers, like University of Chicago political theorist and foreign policy expert Hans Morgenthau. After visiting Vietnam in early 1956, Morgenthau described Diem as a man who acts with a craftiness and ruthlessness worthy of an Oriental despot, who as statesman lives by his opposition to communism, but who is building, down to small details, a faithful replica of the totalitarian regime which he opposes. Morgenthau outlined a situation in which 9 of the 11 opposition parties dared not operate openly. Freedom of the press does not exist, and nobody knows how many people are shot every day by the armed forces of the regime, and under what circumstances. With the United States backing, Diem subverted the most important provision of the Geneva Agreement, canceling the 1956 election that would have turned control of the nation over to the communists. Eisenhower later commented, "I have never talked or corresponded with a person knowledgeable in Indo-Chinese affairs who did not agree that had elections been held as of the time of the fighting, possibly 80% of the population would have voted for the communist Ho Chi Minh as their leader, rather than Chief of State Bao Dai." The insurgency was soon rekindled. Growing U.S. involvement in Vietnam was taking place against a backdrop of heightened nuclear tensions. In late February 1954, U.S. authorities evacuated islanders and cleared all vessels from a large area of the Pacific in preparation for a new series of hydrogen bomb tests. Even though the wind shifted, they decided to proceed as planned with the March 1st Bravo test, knowing that this would put many people in harm's way. To make matters worse, the bomb exploded with twice the force predicted. At 15 megatons, it was 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. The cloud of radioactive coral drifted toward the Marshall Islands of Rongelap, Rongerik, and Utrecht, contaminating 236 islanders and 28 Americans. Unaware of the danger, children played in the radioactive fallout. Many of the islanders were not evacuated for 3 days, by which time they were showing signs of radiation poisoning. 23 fishermen aboard a Japanese trawler, Daigo Fukuryu Maru, Lucky Dragon No. 5, suffered a similar fate, as they were blanketed by the deadly white ash that fell from the skies for 3 hours. When they pulled into port 13 days later with their contaminated tuna, crew members were showing signs of advanced poisoning. The first died several months later. The world was shocked by the United States' negligence and by the incredible power of the latest generation of nuclear weapons. Panic set in when people realized that the Japanese ship's contaminated tuna had been sold in 4 major cities and eaten by scores of people. Many people stopped eating fish entirely. 457 tons of tuna were eventually destroyed. AEC Chairman Louis Strauss told the White House press secretary that the boat had really been a Red Spy outfit conducting espionage for the Soviet Union, a blatant falsehood that the CIA quickly dispelled. Speaking at Eisenhower's press conference, Strauss emphasized the test's contribution to the United States military posture, blamed the fishermen for ignoring AEC warnings, and downplayed the damage to their health. The inhabitants of Utrecht were allowed to return within 2 months. The Rongala Pies did not return home until 1957. They remained in Rongelap until 1985, when scientific findings confirmed their suspicions that the island was still contaminated. The international community was appalled. Belgian diplomat Paul-Henri Spaak warned, "If something is not done to revive the idea of the president's speech, the idea that America wants to use atomic energy for peaceful purposes, America is going to be synonymous in Europe with barbarism and horror." Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru said publicly that U.S. leaders were dangerous, self-centered lunatics who would blow up any people or country who came in the way of their policy. Eisenhower told the NSC in May 1954, "Everybody seems to think that we are skunks, saber-rattlers, and warmongers." Dulles added, "We are losing ground every day in England and in other Allied nations because they are all insisting we are so militaristic. Comparisons are now being made between ours and Hitler's military machine." The bomb test had other unforeseen consequences. The terrifying power of hydrogen bombs and the slightly veiled threat of nuclear war now figured much more prominently in international diplomacy. The nuclear threat influenced the behavior of the major players at the Geneva Conference more than most people realized. Shortly after the test, Churchill told Parliament that the topic occupied his thinking out of all comparison with anything else. Dulles met with him in early May, afterward telling Eisenhower that he found the British, and particularly Churchill, scared to death by the specter of nuclear bombs in the hands of the Russians. Anthony Eden connected this fear to the proceedings at the conference. "This was the first international meeting," he noted, "at which I was sharply conscious of the deterrent power of the hydrogen bomb. I was grateful for it. I do not believe that we should have got through the Geneva Conference and avoided a major war without it." The Lucky Dragon incident also catalyzed a worldwide movement against nuclear testing and popularized the previously obscure term fallout. It sparked renewed questioning of Eisenhower's new look. Nowhere was the reaction stronger than in Japan, where post-war U.S. efforts to censor discussion of the atomic bombings had not succeeded in extinguishing the memory of what the United States had done to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A petition circulated by Tokyo housewives calling for banning hydrogen bombs gathered 32 million signatures, an extraordinary total representing one-third of the entire Japanese population. To counter this pervasive anti-nuclear sentiment, the NSC's Operations Coordinating Board proposed that the United States launch a vigorous offensive on the non-war uses of atomic energy and offer to build Japan an experimental nuclear reactor. AEC Commissioner Thomas Murray applauded this dramatic and Christian gesture, believing it could lift all of us far above the recollection of the carnage of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Washington Post offered its own hearty endorsement, seeing the project as a way to divert the mind of man from his present obsession with the armaments race, and added, in an extraordinary admission, "Many Americans are now aware that the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan was not necessary. How better to make a contribution to amends than by offering Japan the means for the peaceful utilization of atomic energy? How better indeed to dispel the impression in Asia that the United States regards Orientals merely as cannon fodder." In what would seem the cruelest irony yet, Murray and Illinois Representative Sidney Yates proposed building the first nuclear power plant in Hiroshima. In early 1955, Yates introduced legislation to build a 60,000 kilowatt generating plant in the city that less than a decade earlier had been the first target of the atomic bomb. Over the next few years, the U.S. Embassy, the CIA, and the United States Information Agency waged a large-scale propaganda and educational campaign to reverse the Japanese people's deep-seated hostility to nuclear power. The Mainichi newspaper denounced the campaign. First, baptism with radioactive rain. Then a surge of shrewd commercialism in the guise of atoms for peace from abroad. A month after the powerful Bravo test, the New York Times reported that the recent tests confirmed Szilard and Einstein's fear that the cobalt bomb could be built, leading to widespread discussion of Szilard's revised estimate that 400 one-ton deuterium cobalt bombs would release enough radioactivity to end all life on the planet. A front-page article in the Los Angeles Times 2 days later offered the sobering news that Japanese scientist Tsunesaburo Asada had informed the Japan Pharmacological Society that the Soviets were producing a nitrogen bomb, a hydrogen bomb enclosed with nitrogen and helium, so dangerous that if 30 such bombs are detonated simultaneously, all mankind will perish in several years' time. As if that weren't frightening enough, the following February, German Nobel laureate Otto Hahn, the physicist who had first split the uranium atom, lowered the requisite number from 400 cobalt bombs to 10 in a radio address that could be heard throughout most of Europe. Although a cobalt bomb has never been built, the possibility that it could be gave shape to the decade's darkest nightmares. The Lucky Dragon crew members remained hospitalized for more than a year. While recuperating in the hospital, one issued a poignant warning. "Our fate menaces all mankind. Tell that to those who are responsible. God grant that they may listen." Chapter 7. JFK. The most dangerous moment in human history. In October 1962, the United States and the Soviet Union, girded for war with nuclear missiles, pointed at each other's military installations and population centers. The world would come closer to nuclear obliteration than most people realize. For decades, the public has been told that John F. Kennedy's statesmanship and resolve, abetted by Nikita Khrushchev's sober realism, averted a Holocaust. The leaders of the planet's two most powerful nations endeavored to resolve the Cuban Missile Crisis peacefully, but their power to control events was severely limited as the world careened toward disaster. The lessons the two leaders drew from this harrowing encounter convinced them that life on Earth might not survive a continuing Cold War. Their efforts to end that dangerous and wasteful conflict may have spelled doom for them both, but it may also, in the process, have opened up some breathing space for the rest of a threatened humanity. Nikita Khrushchev actually had a lot in common with Kennedy's predecessor, Dwight Eisenhower. Both had humble upbringings. Ike's fifth-grade class photo in Abilene, Kansas, shows him wearing overalls while everyone else wore Sunday clothes. Khrushchev, the grandson of serfs and son of peasants, worked in his youth as a shepherd, coal miner, and machinist. Though brutal as party czar in Ukraine during the 1930s and 1940s, and in his harsh suppression of the Hungarian uprising of 1956, he could also be funny, charming, earthy, and ingratiating. He yearned to set a new course for the Soviet Union. At the 20th Party Congress in February 1956, he accused Stalin of having conducted a dictatorial reign of suspicion, fear, and terror. He decried Stalin's cult of personality and began a desperately needed process of de-Stalinization. Like Eisenhower, he had seen World War II up close and developed a deep abhorrence of war. But he believed as deeply in the superiority of the Soviet system as Eisenhower did in the capitalist system. To prove socialism's superiority over capitalism, he set out to sharply reduce military spending so he could devote greater resources to improving the Soviet people's standard of living, which had long been sacrificed to the exigencies of national defense and self-preservation against seemingly implacable foes. In August 1957, the Soviet Union successfully tested the world's first intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM. For the Soviet Union, ICBMs could potentially offset the enormous military advantage the United States derived from bombers housed at NATO bases in Europe. Less than 2 months later, on October 4th, 1957, while the school desegregation crisis in Little Rock, Arkansas dominated American news, and Leave It to Beaver made its television debut, a Soviet R-7 ICBM launched the first artificial satellite into orbit around the Earth. Sputnik Zemilya, meaning companion of Earth, or fellow traveler, weighed 184 pounds and was 22.8 inches in diameter. It orbited the Earth once every 96 minutes and 17 seconds, transmitting a series of beeps to listeners below. Soviet officials crowed about the triumph of Soviet science and technology, which, they claimed, proved the overall superiority of the Soviet Union's new socialist society. The Soviets had indeed punctured the belief that the United States' technological sophistication and the Soviet Union's backwardness would guarantee U.S. victory in the Cold War. Writer John Gunther noted, "For a generation, it had been part of the American folklore that the Russians were hardly capable of operating a tractor." Radio Cairo declared that Sputnik would make countries think twice before tying themselves to the imperialist policy led by the United States. Khrushchev taunted, "Any idiot can see. They might as well put bombers and fighters in the museum." Drawing attention to both the Soviet achievement and U.S. racial problems, Radio Moscow pointedly announced every time Sputnik passed over Little Rock. Some Americans panicked, speculating that the Soviet Union must now have ICBMs with nuclear warheads poised to attack U.S. targets. That fear was fueled by the Soviet Union's announcement, 3 days after Sputnik's launch, that it had successfully tested a new ballistic missile compatible thermonuclear warhead. Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson warned that the Soviets would soon be dropping bombs on us from space like kids dropping rocks onto cars from freeway overpasses. Edward Teller bemoaned the fact that the United States had lost a battle more important and greater than Pearl Harbor. One satirist cracked, "General LeMay is planning to send a fleet of bombers around the world to impress the Russians. I'm sure it will, if they bother to look down." The Soviets beating the United States into space tore deep cracks in the fragile facade of American confidence, a confidence that had already been shaken by the Korean War and the domestic and foreign policy crises of the first half of the 1950s. Critics decried the shallow materialism and purposelessness of American life and enumerated the shortcomings of the educational system. Republican Senator Stiles Bridges urged Americans to be less concerned with the depth of the pile on the new broadloom rug or the height of the tail fin on the new car, and to be more prepared to shed blood, sweat, and tears if this country and the free world are to survive. Esteemed Soviet space scientist Leonid Sedov commented to a German-American counterpart, "You Americans have a better standard of living than we have, but the American loves his car, his refrigerator, his house. He does not, as we Russians do, love his country." Congresswoman Claire Booth Luce described Sputnik's beep from space as an intercontinental outer space raspberry to a decade of American pretensions that the American way of life was a gilt-edged guarantee of our national superiority. The administration deliberately downplayed the threat posed by the Soviet achievement in an effort to reassure the public. "The satellite does not rouse my apprehensions," Eisenhower said. "Not one iota. I can see nothing that is significant. They have put one small ball into the air." To drive the point home, Ike played 5 rounds of golf that week. He could not disclose the reason for his lack of concern. highly secret U-2 reconnaissance planes, flying above 70,000 feet, had been crossing Soviet airspace for more than a year and taking photos, revealing that the Soviets were lagging behind in the arms race. The American people were kept in the dark about those illegal and provocative missions, but the Soviet Union launched a formal protest in July 1957. Alan Dulles later chortled, "I was able to get a look at every blade of grass in the Soviet Union, but it would still be a few years before this was true." On November 3rd, the Soviets launched Sputnik 2, a massive 6-ton satellite carrying a live dog named Laika. The Soviets reveled in their victory. But Khrushchev used the occasion to reach out to U.S. leaders by calling for peaceful space competition and an end to the Cold War. "Our satellites are waiting for the American and other satellites to join them and to form a commonwealth of satellites. A commonwealth of this kind would be much better than competition in the race to manufacture lethal weapons. We would like a high-level meeting of representatives of capitalist and socialist countries so as to reach an agreement based on the exclusion of war as a method of settling international problems, to stop the Cold War and the armaments race, and to establish relations among states on the basis of coexistence, to settle disputes by means of peaceful competition in the culture and in the best satisfaction of human requirements and needs." Now on the defensive, Eisenhower ignored Khrushchev's overture, instead highlighting the United States' vast military superiority and its intention to stay far ahead in the arms race. "Our nation has enough power in its strategic retaliatory forces to bring near annihilation to the war-making capabilities of any other country. Atomic submarines have been developed. A number of huge naval carriers are in operation, supplied with the most powerful nuclear weapons and bombers of great range to deliver them. Construction has started which will produce a carrier to be driven by atomic power. In numbers, our stock of nuclear weapons is so large and so rapidly growing that we are well ahead of the Soviets, both in quantity and in quality. We intend to stay ahead." Eisenhower knew that words would not suffice. Determined to beat the Soviets at their own game on December 6th, the United States attempted to launch a satellite with a Vanguard rocket. It stayed aloft for only 2 seconds, reaching a height of 4 feet. Newspapers scornfully dubbed the grapefruit-sized sphere Kaputnik, Flopnik, and Stayputnik. Eisenhower finally unleashed the former Nazi rocketeer Wernher von Braun and his army Redstone team to put something up in the air. By January 31st, they successfully orbited a 31-pound Explorer satellite. The United States even contemplated detonating a Hiroshima-sized atomic bomb on the moon to restore its prestige. The resulting dust cloud would have been widely visible from Earth. The study was conducted from May 1958 to January 1959 by a 10-person staff that included the young astronomer Carl Sagan, who worked for the Air Force Special Weapons Center in Albuquerque. Finally, the scientists joined with others in convincing authorities that there was no point in ruining the pristine environment of the moon. Later in the decade, the Air Force devised even more grandiose schemes. Testifying before the House Armed Services Committee in February 1958, Lieutenant General Donald Pott disclosed plans for missile bases on the moon. Pott explained, "Warheads could be catapulted from shafts sunk deep into the moon's surface, providing a retaliation base of considerable advantage over earthbound nations if the United States were militarily destroyed. An enemy wanting to take out those bases prior to attacking on Earth would have to launch an overwhelming nuclear attack against those bases 1 to 2 days prior to attacking the continental United States, clearly signaling that such an attack was coming." Air Force Assistant Secretary Richard Horner later testified that such bases could break a nuclear stalemate on Earth and restore the United States' first strike capability. Putt added that if the Soviets established their own moon bases to neutralize the United States' advantage, the United States could erect bases on more distant planets, from which it could retaliate against both the Soviet Union and its moon bases. In assessing those plans, the independent journalist I.F. Stone astutely noted that the Latin word for moon is luna, and suggesting that the military establish a fourth branch for space warfare, and call it the Department of Lunacy. Propelled by irrational fear of being overtaken by the Soviets, intelligence officials advanced preposterous estimates of Soviet military strength. In December 1957, a national intelligence estimate projected a potential Soviet arsenal of 100 operational ICBMs in the next 2 years, and projected a worst-case scenario of 500 Soviet ICBMs in 1960. Eisenhower commissioned a top-secret security review, headed by H. Rowan Gaither of the Ford Foundation. The report predicted that by 1959, the USSR may be able to launch an attack with ICBMs carrying megaton warheads, against which SAC will be almost completely vulnerable under present programs. It recommended commencing a massive U.S. military buildup to counter the growing missile gap, increasing the number of Titan and Atlas ICBMs to be deployed in 1959 from 80 to 600, and increasing the number of Thor and Jupiter intermediate-range ballistic missiles to be placed in Europe from 60 to 240. It also called for a $25 billion national fallout shelter program. When the report was leaked to the press, the Washington Post painted a dire picture. The still top-secret Gaither report portrays the United States in the gravest danger in its history. It pictures the nation moving in frightening course to the status of a second-class power. It shows an America exposed to an almost immediate threat from the missile-bristling Soviet Union. It finds America's long-term prospect one of cataclysmic peril in the face of rocketing Soviet military might and of a powerful, growing Soviet economy and technology. To prevent what otherwise appears to be an inevitable catastrophe, the Gaither Report urgently calls for an enormous increase in military spending, from now through 1970. Sputnik provided Democrats a tremendous political opening. A legislative aide informed Lyndon Johnson that the issue, if properly handled, would blast the Republicans out of the water and elect you president. Taking the cue, the Senate launched an inquiry into Eisenhower's defense programs. Among those who jumped enthusiastically on this missile gap bandwagon was the junior senator from Massachusetts, John F. Kennedy. By late 1957, Kennedy was warning that the United States might be several years behind the Soviets in intermediate and long-range ballistic missiles. Egged on by his friend, the columnist Joseph Alsop, he adopted an even more alarmist tone the following year. Alsop had accused the Eisenhower administration of gross untruth regarding U.S. national defense. He detailed the scope of the projected missile gap. In 1959, the United States would have zero ICBMs, the Soviets 100. In succeeding years, the ratio would be 30 U.S. to 500 Soviet in 1960, 70 to 1,000 in 1961, 130 to 1,500 in 1962, and 130 to 2,000 in 1963. Relying largely on Alsop's information, Kennedy rose up in the Senate to decry the U.S. missile lag, which would soon produce a peril more deadly than any wartime danger we have ever known, increasing the possibility of a Soviet attack and making nuclear disarmament more urgent than ever. Eisenhower, whose U-2 surveillance planes had failed to identify a single deployed ICBM, had little patience for Washington insiders who tried to exploit the missile gap to advance their own careers. He dismissed them as sanctimonious, hypocritical bastards. U.S. interests and prestige were dealt another devastating blow when revolutionaries, led by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, toppled Cuba's U.S.-friendly dictator, Fulgencio Batista, on New Year's Day 1959. American corporations had dominated the island since 1898. In 1959, they controlled more than 80% of Cuba's mines, cattle ranches, utilities, and oil refineries, 50% of the railroads, and 40% of the sugar industry. The United States still retained its naval base at Guantanamo Bay. Castro quickly set about reforming the education system and redistributing land. The government seized more than 1 million acres from United Fruit and two other American companies. When the United States tried to strangle the new regime economically, Castro turned to the Soviet Union for aid. On March 17, 1960, Eisenhower instructed the CIA to organize a paramilitary force of Cuban exiles to overthrow Castro. During the coming months, the United States, with Eisenhower's authorization, would also be involved in an effort to assassinate Patrice Lumumba, the democratically elected prime minister of the resource-rich Congo, whom Alan Dulles characterized as an African Fidel Castro. Lumumba was indeed assassinated the following January. But the Congo's former colonial rulers, the Belgians, deserve the lion's share of the blame. The CIA backed Joseph Mobutu to succeed Lumumba. After several years of struggle, Mobutu managed to consolidate his control. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning history of the CIA, Legacy of Ashes, Tim Weiner assessed Mobutu's reign.